Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 284, titled Hearken Unto Me, Business as Usual for the Bush Family. The title is a pun on Harken Energy, spelled H-A-R-K-E-N. That's one of the many Bush family oil dabblings, so to speak. And we're going to be talking about the Bush family, Bush family businesses, and how the Bush family and their associates take care of business, much as the business of Orlando Letelier was taken care of on September 3rd, 1976 in Washington, D.C. He was blown up. We're going to be talking about Operation Condor and some of its many connections. That was an operation involving elements of U.S. intelligence with fascist elements in Latin America, whose heritage stretches all the way back to and includes elements of what I call the Underground Reich. And by the way, this program is being recorded on March 18th of the year 2001. We're going to begin with an article from the Financial Times of London's weekend issue of March 17th and March 18th of the year 2001. The following story is by James Wilson in Bogota. It's headlined, Harken Tightens Security in Colombia, and it reads in part as follows. Harken Energy Corporation, the U.S. oil and gas exploration company, has warned of increased security risks to its investments in Colombia, partly due to recent publicity surrounding the company's links to President George W. Bush. Skipping down. Cambio, C-A-M-B-I-O, a leading Colombian news magazine, devoted this week's cover story to Mr. Bush's ties to Harken and Colombia. Mr. Bush became associated with Houston-based Harken in 1986 when Harken bought Spectrum 7, the oil company of which he was president. Left-wing guerrillas opposed to U.S. investment in Colombia frequently attack the oil industry. Attacks have stepped up since last year when the U.S. deepened its involvement in Colombia with a $1.3 billion anti-drug aid package that rebels oppose. Several oil companies lobbied the U.S. Congress for the aid, and Mr. Bush's administration has confirmed its support. I would note that Harken Energy swung some deals within the Persian Gulf right about the time of the Persian Gulf War when George Bush the Elder, George the First as I call him, was involved along with James Baker, his then Secretary of State, who led the Florida recount for his son. That Harken oil deal involved drilling rights off of Bahrain, and it was one of many pieces of business taken care of by both Bushes, particularly the elder Bush, for the benefits of the younger. There's a very significant Bush family business involvement, one which involves George the First and which will be benefiting George the Second. This is also an involvement that a business arrangement that involves many associates of both Georges Bush, and in particular, this particular business arrangement, a firm called Carlyle Investments, was the vehicle for which George the First conferred with Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia during the presidential campaign. Now, in For the Record programs number 214 and 236, I dealt with a precipitous oil price. Actually, it's called Carlyle Group, excuse me. I dealt with a precipitous oil price increase in not only 1979-80, but also in the year 2000, when both Georges Bush were running on the Republican ticket for vice president and president, respectively. The 79-80 oil price increase helped to doom Jimmy Carter, as discussed in For the Record Program 214, and the oil price increase of the year 2000 helped to dampen the economy and brighten the electoral prospects as a result for George II, that discussed in both 214 and 236. We're going to take a look now at an article about the Carlyle Group that appeared in the New York Times of Monday, March 5th of the year 2001. This is an article by Leslie Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E, Dateline Washington, and headlined, Elder Bush in Big GOP Cast Toiling for Top Equity Firm. Now note in particular of the Carlyle Group's role as the vehicle under which George Bush, the former president, conferred with Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia during the presidential campaign. The question I'm asking is, to what extent did they perhaps make arrangements for keeping the price of crude high in order to deep-six the electoral prospects for Al Gore? That is what happened, apparently, in 1979 and 80. I believe that also happened. It was done deliberately in the year 2000. And the dealings between George Bush the Elder, George the First, and the Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia under the auspices of the Carlyle Group may very well have been the vehicle under which or through which that took place. Turning once again to the New York Times of Monday, March 5th of the year 2001, we read of the Carlyle Group. During the presidential campaign last year, former President George Bush took time off from his son's race to call on Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia at a luxurious desert compound outside Riyadh to talk about American-Saudi business affairs. Mr. Bush went as an ambassador of sorts, but not for his government. In the same way, Mr. Bush's Secretary of State, James A. Baker III, recently met with a group of wealthy people at the elegant Lanesborough Hotel in London to explain the Florida vote count. Traveling with the fanfare of dignitaries, Mr. Bush and Mr. Baker were using their extensive government contacts to further their business interests as representatives of the Carlyle Group, a $12 billion private equity firm based in Washington that has parlayed a roster of former top-level government officials, largely from the Bush and Reagan administrations, into a money-making machine. In a new spin on Washington's revolving door between business and government, where lobbying by former officials is restricted but soliciting investments is not, Carlyle has upped the ante and taken the practice global. Mr. Bush and Mr. Baker were accompanied on their trips by former Prime Minister John Major of Britain, another of Carlyle's political stars. With door openers of this caliber, along with shrewd investment skills, Carlyle has gone from an unknown in the world of private equity to one of its biggest players. Private equity, which involves buying up companies in private deals and reselling them, as a high-end business open only to the very rich. Over the last decade, the Carlyle Empire has grown to span three continents and include investments in most corners of the world. It owns so many companies that it is now in effect one of the nation's biggest defense contractors and a force in global telecommunications. Its blue-chip investors include major banks and insurance companies, billion-dollar pension funds, and wealthy investors from Abu Dhabi to Singapore. In getting business for Carlyle, Mr. Bush has been impressive. His meeting with the Crown Prince was followed by a yacht cruise and private dinners with Saudi officials, including King Fahd, all on behalf of Carlyle, which has extensive interests in the Middle East. For instance, Frank C. Carlucci, a Reagan Secretary of Defense, who as much as anyone is responsible for Carlyle's success, said he met in February with his old college classmate Donald H. Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and Vice President Dick Cheney, himself a Defense Secretary under former President Bush, to talk about military matters at a time when Carlyle has several billion-dollar defense projects under consideration. Skipping down again, quote, "Carlyle is as deeply wired into the current administration as they can possibly be," unquote, said Charles Lewis, executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit public interest group based in Washington. George Bush is getting money from private interests that have business before the government while his son is president. And, in a really peculiar way, George W. Bush could someday benefit financially from his own administration's decisions through his father's investments. The average American doesn't know that, and to me, that's a jaw-dropper, unquote. Skipping down again. Carlyle also gave the Bush family a hand in 1990 by putting George W. Bush, who was then struggling to find a career, on the board of a Carlyle subsidiary, Cater Air, an airline catering company. And, skipping down again, and its access extends well beyond American shores. In Europe, Carlyle has assembled an advisory board that besides Mr. Major includes Karl Otto Pohl, former president of Germany's Bundesbank, and the past or present chairman of BMW, Hoffmann La Roche, Nestle, LVMH Moët Hennessy, Louis Vuitton, and Aérospatiale, the French Airbus partner. Carlyle's Asia Advisory Board, which helps raise money and funds and reviews deals, includes former President Fidel V. Ramos of the Philippines, the former Prime Minister of Thailand, and the Executive Director of the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. The former South Korean Prime Minister Park Tae-jun was also an advisor to Carlyle. And skipping down yet again, one of the people who put Carlyle on the map, developing its riches and its image, is Mr. Carlucci, who joined the firm in 1989 when it had engaged in a string of ill-fated ventures. He is credited with steering Carlyle into successful defense industry acquisitions, just when other investors were shunning them, and with using his seat on more than a dozen corporate boards to bring Carlyle deals and investors. In an office adorned with photographs of Mr. Carlucci and the politically mighty, He sits beneath an Oval Office picture of himself and Mr. Reagan. Mr. Carlucci makes it clear that his extensive government and global ties are as fresh as ever. Quote, "I know Rumsfeld extremely well," Mr. Carlucci said in an interview. "We've been close friends throughout the years. We were college classmates," unquote. Note the Carlyle Group, note the fact that it has more connections than a switchboard, note the fact that George W. Bush was put on the board of one of its companies in 1990, note that James Baker and George I are heavy hitters with and major players with the Carlyle Group, and note in particular the fact that former President Bush met with Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia during the presidential campaign last year to discuss American-Saudi business affairs. One wonders whether perhaps an oil price gambit, not unlike that of 1979-80, which Bush also apparently helped to midwife, might very well have been on the front burner, and whether Carlyle was a vehicle for effecting just that. There's been a lot of attention on the CD pardons that were obtained by people with the Clinton administration during its closing days, although the coverage has been badly skewed on the Mark Rich pardon, overlooking, among other things, Mark Rich's many ties with Republicans. He was represented by a number of prominent Republican attorneys, including Louis Libby, Dick Cheney's current chief of staff. Also note the fact that Mark Rich was involved with using Agriculture Department credits to deal through the BCCI. In the 1980s, and we're not hearing about that. That's discussed in For the Record program number 277. George I was a great pardoner, and a discussion of some of the people he pardoned was carried in the Los Angeles Times of Tuesday, March 6th of the year 2001. This op-ed column was by Robert Scheer, S-C-H-E-E-R. Its headline, "Many a U.S. President Pays the Pardon Piper," and it's about some of the people pardoned by George Bush, George I. The media coverage of the Clinton pardons has been so biased, overblown, and vituperative as to call into question the very purpose of what currently passes as journalism. It is difficult to recall a more partisan, one-sided hatchet job, and skipping down. But unforgivable is what former President George Bush did. He protected himself, a former Reagan administration official, in an ongoing investigation when he pardoned Reagan's defense secretary Caspar Weinberger and the rest of the Iran-Contra Gang of Six. At the time, independent counsel Lawrence E. Walsh bitterly charged that the Iran-Contra cover-up, which has continued for more than 6 years, has now been completed, unquote, by presidential fiat. Walsh called it, again quoting, "evidence of a conspiracy among the highest-ranking Reagan administration officials to lie to Congress and the American public," unquote, and said that, again quoting, "in light of President Bush's own misconduct," unquote, he was gravely concerned, unquote, about Bush's decision to pardon others. Bush could easily have been said to have covered up his own potential culpability, far short of anything Clinton has been accused of doing in his pardon for Mark Rich or anyone else. Nor did the Bush-Iran-Contra pardons pass the one more pardon before leaving the White House smell test, so liberally applied to Clinton's pardons. The pardon came after intensive lobbying by former Reagan aides and many last-minute White House meetings. By the way, one of the things Lawrence Walsh was investigating was a meeting at which George Bush was reportedly present that helped to effect some of the Iran-Contra machinations, and Matthew Gannon and Charles McKee, two military intelligence operatives who died on Pan Am 103, were present at that particular meeting. Of course, their death silenced them with regard to any potential evidence that they might have given. That was almost exactly the same time. Pan Am 103 on December 21st of 1988 was brought down at almost the exact same time as the Bush pardons alluded to here. George Bush, by the way, also pardoned anti-Castro Cuban and former CIA operative Orlando Bosch, whose Karoo organization was not only an intimate element of what freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger called the International Fascista, but in turn the International Fascista embracing fascist elements in Europe and Latin America, whose heritage stretches back to and includes elements of the Third Reich, and that International Fascista also overlaps and involves elements of U.S. intelligence. The International Fascista, in addition to involving the Karoo organization of Orlando Bosch, was also involved with the assassination of Orlando Letelier, the former Chilean ambassador to the United United States. That took place on September 3, 1976 in Washington, D.C., when George Bush was director of the CIA. The pardon that George Bush extended to Orlando Bosch was lobbied for by his son Jeb, and the connections between Jeb Bush and Orlando Bosch and Carew and the Internacional Fascista and the Letelier assassination were covered at great length and in detail in numerous broadcasts, and most recently in For the Record program number 259, Beating the Bush in Florida. I would also note that in For the Record program number 268, I took a look at information that was researched by the brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Dale Scott, which links directly the milieu of the assassination of Orlando Letelier with the efforts on behalf of George W. Bush in Florida, and specifically the storming of the Miami-Dade electoral office that had so much publicity. That was affected by members of the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, and the pot was stirred by Radio Mambi, and that in turn was connected with an organization headed up by Jorge Mas Canosa, who was directly linked to anti-Castro Cuban elements connected to the assassination of Orlando Letelier and to the Iran-Contra scandal, and those elements were viewed with open favor by George Bush. Of Jeb Bush's lobbying on behalf of Orlando Bosch and George the Elder's pardoning of Orlando Bosch, we read as follows in this Robert Scheer column from Tuesday, March 6th. Imagine the outcry if Clinton had pardoned an immigrant exile accused of masterminding an airline bombing that cost the lives of 73 people, including 24 teenage members of an Olympic fencing team. Yet that is what George Bush did in acceding to the requests of his son Jeb to pardon Orlando Bosch, gaining Jeb's support in Miami's exile Cuban community. And note again that Carew of Orlando Bosch, deeply connected to the Internacional Fascista Operation Condor and the assassination of Orlando Letelier. That covered in, among other shows, most recently For the Record 259 and the links between that milieu and the Florida machinations in For the Record 268. An article linking a U.S. intelligence communications center to the assassination of Orlando Letelier and Operation Condor was carried in the New York Times of Tuesday, March 6th of the year 2001, the same day that the LA Times carried that Robert Scheer column. This is an article titled, New Files Tie U.S. to Deaths of Latin Leftists in 1970s. It's by Diana Jean Schemo, S-C-H-E-M-O, Stateline, Washington, March 5th, and it reads in part as follows. A recently declassified State Department document shows that Latin American officers involved in Operation Condor, the joint effort in the 1970s by right-wing governments to crush left-wing opposition, used an American communications installation to share intelligence. A cable to the State Department in 1978 from the United States Ambassador to Paraguay at the time, Robert E. White, quoted the chief of staff to the dictator Alfredo Stroessner as saying an American installation in the Canal Zone was employed to coordinate intelligence information, unquote, among South American countries. Obviously, the cable said, this is the Condor network, which all of us have heard about over the last few years. And, skipping down, officially, Condor arose as a defense against communist-inspired terrorism, but its victims included government officials ousted in United States-supported military coups, trade unionists, rights advocates, and suspected socialists. By 1978, investigators were tying Condor to the killing of Orlando Letelier, the former Chilean foreign minister, and Ronnie Moffat, an American colleague, in 1976 when the car in which they were riding exploded in Washington. Skipping down. Mr. White surmised that in telling him American channels were being used to transmit intelligence for Condor, the generals hoped to fend off questions from the United States Justice Department about their role in the killings. The cable said Condor nations keep in touch with one another through a U.S. communications installation on the Panama Canal Zone, which covers all of Latin America, unquote. Again, quoting, this communications facility is used mainly by student officers to call home to Latin America, unquote, the cable continued, but it is also employed to coordinate intelligence information among the Southern Cone countries. They maintain the confidentiality of their communication through the U.S. facility in Panama by using bilateral codes, unquote. Note this use of a U.S. communications center, a U.S. intelligence communications center in Panama. We're going to listen now to an excerpt from Radio Free America program number 20, part of the series of in dealing with the shooting of the Pope. This broadcast, RFA 20, was recorded on May 22nd. Of 1986. You're going to hear my former co-host Nip Tuck reading from the book Secrets of the SS by Glenn Infield, copyright 1981 by Stein and Day, and you're going to be hearing about links between Operation Condor and a Nazi emigre colony in Chile called Colonia Dignidad. So, from RFA 20 from 5/22/86 and Secrets of the SS by Glenn Infield, the following deals with Operation Condor. Note in particular the communication center at Colonia Dignidad.
We're going to read about that from a section of the book Secrets of the SS by Glenn B. Infield, copyright 1981, Stein and Day. When the prominent Chilean exile Orlando Letelier was brutally assassinated in Washington, D.C. in September 1976, few investigators of the crime gave a thought to Hitler's SS at the time. When the American expatriate Michael Vernon Townley testified that he had wired Letelier's car with explosives on orders from the chief of Chile's secret police, General Juan Manuel Contreras, the assassination became a political bombshell in the United States. President Carter demanded that Contreras be extradited to the United States to stand trial, and when Chilean President Augusto Pinochet refused, the U.S. ambassador to Chile was recalled, pushing relations with Chile nearly to the breaking point. However, the CIA, FBI, and investigative agencies of other countries, as they delved deeper into the murder of Letelier, traced the plot back to a secret organization in South America called Operation Condor. Operation Condor, they discovered, is an intelligence-gathering organization that concentrates on leftists around the world, and especially those who are exiled from any of Condor's member countries, Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Uruguay, and Paraguay. According to a top-secret report issued by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Condor has special teams assigned to travel anywhere in the world to assassinate persons on the Condor, quote, hit list. It was then learned, through further investigation, that the headquarters of Condor was in Chile, and the organization worked very closely with the DINA, the Chilean secret police headed by Contreras. The trial then led to an enclave deep in the foothills of the Chilean Andes, south of Santiago, an enclave known only as the Colony to outsiders, but officially named Colonia Dignidad, Noble Colony, by the Chilean government. Regardless of what name it is called, the secret colony is actually a Nazi stronghold that is protected by the Chilean government and which works very closely with the DINA. Informed sources within the Chilean government state that one of the responsibilities of the ex-Gestapo and ex-SS officers at Colonia Dignidad is to demonstrate Nazi torture methods for the Chilean secret police and to instruct the DINA in such brutality. These sources verified that there is a detention camp for Chilean political prisoners within the colony. Colonia Dignidad was established in Chile in 1961 by German ex-Luftwaffe officer Paul Schaefer. He began his organization shortly after World War II in Hulpdorf, Germany, then moved it to Seeburg, a town near Bonn. Schaefer guaranteed the defeated German citizens both the spiritual and material needs they craved during these harsh post-war years. He also promised anonymity to those Germans who joined his group. This was a powerful lure for many of the SS men on the run from Allied investigators. They quickly joined Schaefer, and when he moved the entire organization from Germany to Chile in 1961, his SS membership was pleased, since South America was known to be a safe haven for unreconstructed Nazis. The reason for the move to Chile has never been verified, but it is thought that Schaefer was guaranteed complete independence for his colony by the Chilean government. In return, Schaefer's SS men were to train the Chilean secret police. During the same period, ex-SS officers and German military personnel were being hired by Argentina, Egypt, and many other countries for the same purpose. Whether or not Skorzeny had a hand in the Colonia Dignidad affair remains a secret. His other such activities elsewhere, however, suggest that he probably did help Schaefer set up the deal with the Chilean government. According to one investigator, Charles A. Kraus, it is not even permissible to take a photograph of the front gate of the enclave. Quote, I was threatened with arrest by police who finally took from me an undeveloped roll of film with pictures of Dignidad's entrance, taken from outside its gates. The police, who wore no identification badges, would only say that they were from Parral, about 20 miles to the west, and that they were acting on orders from Santiago. He did learn that the colony has its own airstrip, its own fleet of aircraft, and a private communication system. The elaborate communication system permits Schaefer and his colleagues to keep in radio contact with a, quote, mother house in Seaburg, and with a mansion in Santiago that is filled with modern electronic communications equipment. The entire 15,000-acre enclave is enclosed by a high barbed wire fence, and citizens of the area say that it is the place where, quote, nobody comes and nobody goes. The proximity of the Argentine border and the private airstrip and fleet of planes makes it easy for inhabitants of the colony to leave and return without any normal customs formalities. It makes an ideal secret hideout for Nazis on the run. Both the CIA and Simon Wiesenthal, the famed Nazi hunter, state they have evidence that such fugitives as Dr. Josef Mengele, the Third Reich's Angel of Death, have spent time at Colonia Dignidad. There is also evidence that Schaefer is in contact with pro-Nazi groups around the world, and that large amounts of money are sent to Colonia Dignidad each year by such groups. The saying that nobody comes and nobody goes at Colonia Dignidad applies only to the regular members of the enclave, not the leaders. When called upon, the ex-SS men of the colony are not reluctant to go any place in the world to help their former SS and Nazi comrades.
That again from RFA number 20 from May 22nd of 1986. That in turn excerpted from Secrets of the SS by Glenn Infield and read very competently by my former co-host Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Also from Radio Free America number 20 from the same date is the following excerpt. This is taken from the book The Nazi Legacy, Klaus Barbie and the International Fascist Connection, tri-authored by Magnus Linklater, Neil Asherson, and Isabel Hinton, published in hardcover by Holt Reinhardt Winston in 1984, and this deals with former Lyon, France Gestapo chief Klaus Barbie, whose work for U.S. intelligence is a matter of public record, and his work as a liaison officer with Operation Condor. Another interesting connection between this whole P2 and U.S. intelligence tangle and Operation Condor, and through that, Colonia Dignidad, was carried in a book called The Nazi Legacy. We've used it before, subtitled Klaus Barbie and the International Fascist Connection. Three authors, Magnus Linklater, Isabel Hilton, and Neil Asherson, all of them British journalists, published in hardcover by Holt Reinhardt and Winston, copyrighted 1984. Finally, as if to emphasize the many levels on which Barbie was now operating, a CIA report shows that the agency approved a meeting organized by Barbie in 1977 in the tropical Yungas region of Bolivia, between representatives of the Chilean and Bolivian intelligence services. Barbie himself attended it. According to a Bolivian official who was there, the discussion centered around coordination between the two services and the promotion of Condor, a system of mutual aid between right-wing regimes in Latin America, promoted by the U.S. to unify their anti-subversion activities. So apparently, Barbie connected with Operation Condor and working with the Chilean Secret Service in connection with that. That again excerpted from RFA 20 from May 22nd of 1986, and in turn taken from The Nazi Legacy, Klaus Barbie and the International Fascist Connection by Magnus Linklater, Neil Asherson, and Isabel Hinton, copyright 1984 by Holt Reinhardt Winston. So look at the numerous links between post-World War II SS operatives in the milieu that they were involved with, which ultimately would include Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller and the Bormann Group, and Operation Condor and their links to the Bush milieu. This concludes For the Record program number 284, Hearken Unto Me, Business as Usual for the Bush Family, being recorded on March 18th of the year 2001. A detailed and annotated description of For the Record number 284 is available on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. You can also access real audio archives of the For the Record programs at the website of sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. You can access those files at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. This is Dave Emery, and this concludes For the Record program number 284. Thanks for listening.